History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned is they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions and then invest a little time to listen as memories from long, long ago start to come to life again. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired when our veterans let us into the experiences they've been carrying with them for all these years. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, you know we've focused almost exclusively on World War II veterans over the years. But in the future, I'm sure we're going to be hearing more and more from veterans who served in later conflicts. They're not getting any younger either. And when it comes to the Vietnam generation, many of those who served are dealing with the long-term effects of exposure to Agent Orange. Decorated helicopter pilot Harry Zinser of Hanford, California is one of them. A 26-year veteran of the Navy who later launched the junior ROTC program at Lemoore High School, where he spoke as strongly and clearly as could be as a history teacher, Harry now battles Parkinson's disease because of exposure to Agent Orange. That has affected his speech, but it has not stolen his memories, which are pretty intense and colorful. And this month, he marked the 50th anniversary of a daring rescue mission in Vietnam that earned him the Navy Cross. We're going to hear all about that, but as we always do, let's start with the early years. Tell us where you grew up, Harry.
I grew up in Flint, Michigan. My parents were both immigrants from Germany. Dad came over in 1923. He said he came through Ellis Island, of course. He said he didn't have 10 cents to buy a cup of coffee, but he had a promise of a job in New York. So that's where he settled in New York, Brooklyn, New York, as a butcher. I was born in New York. I was 1 year old, we moved to Detroit. Then when I was started school, I was in Flint, Michigan. I was there through high school. And I had an older brother who lived in the house with me. His name was Herb. We were both named after presidents. So our parents wanted us to have American names. My brother was born, Herbert Hoover was president. I was born, Harry Truman was president.
So growing up there in Flint, do you remember as a child having some thoughts of, hey, when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do? Did you ever think at that young of an age that you might be a pilot someday?
No, never thought I was going to be a pilot. I always planned on being a coach. I played football in high school, played football in college, so I was going to be a coach. Mm. And my goal was to be a Big Ten coach. That was my goal.
What position did you play?
Well, in high school, I was a quarterback, and then I was transferred to a halfback in college. I enjoyed playing halfback very much for Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois.
Any fun memories from your college football days that stand out?
Oh, yeah, I have lots of memories. Like, I remember... When I was a freshman, I was dressed for varsity. I was one of two freshmen dressed for varsity games. I played left half behind an all-state halfback. He was a very good player. It was Dean Troyer, and he got injured. And I thought I was a third back. So all of a sudden, Coach Zinser, get in. Man alive, I got in there, and it was the first game of the year. It was a night game, and it was raining. We'd been from Michigan. It was just my climate, you know. So I plowed straight ahead. I was nicknamed Harry the Horse after that game. I dragged a few people across the goal line once or twice. Like, I had a great game. That was my first game.
So your very first game in college is one of only two freshmen that's actually dressed. Your number gets called, and you're dragging people across the goal line and getting your own nickname. That's a pretty good debut.
I'd say it was pretty good, yes.
How long did they call you Harry the Horse?
Well, for the 4 years that I was there.
I'm sure you had some other good games or some other big memories.
Well, I remember one game we played North Central College, which is a powerhouse football in our league. My brother, he came from Michigan, and he drove up there because he wanted to watch me play that game. He got there about 2 minutes after the game started, and we were ahead 7-0 already. He asked somebody to say next to me, he said, where did you get 7 points from? They said, first play of the game, the halfback ran for a touchdown. So the first play of the game, I got a 65-yard TD run. That was my senior year.
But your brother missed it.
And my brother missed it, yes.
Well, I know you've lived a lot of life since then, but it's the start of college football season right now, and there's a lot of young men who are dreaming about, you know, them being Harry the Horse and dragging guys across the goal line or running 65 yards. Is there something you look back on and see that 4 years of college football did for you, an impact that playing college football had on you?
Well, I think so. I think it teaches you a lot. It teaches you how to It's How to Live, I think. Good Principles.
Is there a coach that had a specific influence on you?
Yes, both my head coach and our backfield coach at Wheaton College. Head coach was Jack Schwartz. He's a great guy, and then our backfield coach is Bubba. We call him Bubba. Yeah, he's a cool guy.
And this was an interesting time to be a college football player or a college student in general because the Vietnam War is going on. How did you feel about the prospect of ending up in the service? Were you concerned about being drafted? Did you have other plans?
Yes, I had other plans. Like I said, I plan on being a coach. And then suddenly my senior year comes, and we're sitting around our dining hall, and we all open our mail there, and I had a draft notice. Oh, wow, what do I do now? Said, you have until such and such a date to find a service of your choice. If you're not enrolled in a service of your choice by such and such a date, you'll be drafted into the Army. So I said, man, the Army, the life expectancy of an infantry officer was 2.5 months. And well, man, did I go to college for 2.5 months? No, so what else do I do? One guy said, hey, come down, take a test with me. I said, I'm going to be a Navy pilot. I remember saying to him, you mean an Air Force pilot? He said, no, Navy pilot. I said, Navy pilot? Says, Navy has pilots? Well, I thought they just had ships. Did you ever hear of aircraft carriers, Harry? Sure, I've heard of aircraft carriers. Who do you think flies off of them? The Navy, huh? So then I took the test, and I passed the test.
Did you have an idea of what kind of pilot you wanted to be, what you wanted to fly?
I wanted to fly the big Super Connies. Before I went to flight training, I had a... 1 weekend there, Pensacola, 1968. Well, 1 week before I got married. I got married in November. We drove down to Pensacola. There's a honeymoon. It took about 2 weeks to get down there. Went down to Pensacola, Florida. And we got down on a Friday afternoon, and we looked for a place to live. We found a place Saturday morning. We moved in Sunday. Monday, I had to report the flight training. And that's how fast the turnaround time was down in Pensacola, Florida. So I had a new wife. So she said, when should I pick you up? I said, well, it's the Navy. I said, we'll probably be done about 3 o'clock. But it says, most people around 3:30 or 4 o'clock. There'll probably be some paperwork that I have to sign or something. Sure. I didn't see her for 7 weeks. That's how much I knew about Navy training. So I got to call her 7 weeks later. I got to call her. I met her at chapel. Hey, are we still married? She says, yeah, we're married. Well, fantastic.
You were questioning whether she might have bailed on you because you couldn't talk to her?
Yes. She had gotten a teaching job. She was all set.
And did you train on fixed-wing aircraft?
Yes. I was in the last class. I got to land on a carrier in the fixed-wing aircraft. After that class, if you went helicopters, you did not get to fly fixed-wing. So I flew the T-34, then I flew the T-28. We had instrument training in the T-28, and then I flew the T-28 on a carrier. Then I went into helicopters after that.
And was that because you wanted to go to helicopters or they wanted you to?
Yes, I chose helicopters, yes. I'm out in the yard one day. These helicopters fly over my house where we were living. We were living in Milton, Florida, which is real close to Ellison Field. And all of a sudden, I look up and I see wave after wave of helicopters. So I hopped in the car and said, they landed at Ellison Field. So I drove up there. I sat a sticker on my car so I could get in the base. Told one of the pilots there. He says, yeah. He says, these are new training helicopters. They're brand new Bell helicopters, the Bell H-57s. And they look new and they smell new. They have new smell in them and everything. And that's cool. I want to fly these. So that's why I chose helicopters.
And for someone who's never experienced it, how would you explain the difference between flying a fixed-wing aircraft and a helicopter?
They fly exactly the same until you get to hover. You slow down a helicopter, you go into a hover. And in fixed-wing, you slow down, you crash. So you got to keep airspeed up in a fixed-wing airplane. So hovering was a little bit challenging at first. They would always fly us out to a field. That always puts in a corner. That was for why they put us in a corner of the field. Why don't they put us on the middle of the field? That was landing right in a corner of the field where we couldn't move right or left or forward. So it taught us to hover.
It sounds like you took to it pretty naturally. It became pretty comfortable for you?
Well, I don't like to do it naturally, but I finally developed skills that it took, yes.
And how did you feel about the prospect of heading overseas?
Well, it didn't really bother me that much because I was going to Atsugi, Japan, and I really didn't know what was going to happen there over there. So it was a big move for both of my wife and I. Our helicopter training took place at Imperial Beach, California. From there, we went to Atsugi, Japan. From Atsugi, Japan, we deployed to the Tonkin Gulf, though. I guess I wasn't aware of that.
Surprise. And explain to all of us what your unit was and what you guys were expected to do.
Our unit was called HC-7. We had two helicopters. We had Clementines, those were the H-2s. The H-3s, they were called Big Mothers. So I had two deployments as an H-2 pilot, so I was a Clementine pilot for two deployments. Then as I was ready to make aircraft commander, the H-2, the Navy, or our squadron, will say our H-2s, a new program for H-2s called LAMPS, Light Airborne Multipurpose systems. So we lost our H-2s, so we just had H-3s. So our squadron, now we needed more H-3 pilots. Our skipper, commanding officer, he called up our admiral, I need some H-3 pilots. And our skipper, he told the admiral, said, I've got a couple H-2 pilots, I'd like to train them, I'd like to transition them into H-3s. The admiral agreed. So we had five flights with our squadron in the H-3 helicopter, about the use of the FRS. Normally you go through an FRS when you fly a new airplane. So my co-pilot and I were the only two people that I know of that transitioned just within the squadron. So our squadron, they gave us five flights in a helicopter, the H-3. It is HH-3 Alphas in our helicopters. HH is a heavy helicopter, 3 Alpha, the big mothers. But we had to take a check ride from the FRS, Fleet Replacement Squadron, which was HS-10. So the HS-10 instructor, he comes over to our squadron, briefs with us, and he tells us what to expect and everything. So we said, yeah, okay. So the first thing he did, he snagged an engine on takeoff. That's what they do in HS-10. They snag an engine on takeoff, and they see how you react. What he didn't realize, our helicopters are 3,000 pounds heavier because of the armament we have. We have 3,000 pounds of armament. He didn't realize that. So he pulled the snag of the engine back. We're used to it, though, so I had to lower the collective really fast to save the RPM. But it all happened so fast. He snagged the engine back. The RPM just drooped down. Then our warning light comes on. Then our rotor speed comes on. It goes below 90%, and I lowered the collective real fast and landed softly on the runway. He said, call for a pad. So I was still right at Imperial Beach. They have pads for training. So I said, call for a pad. We got pad 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Landed there. He said, thanks for saving my butt. And I said, why? What do you mean? He says, these helicopters are pretty heavy, aren't they? Said, yeah, they're heavy. He says, you just passed your check ride. He says, then I explained to me the differences between your helicopter and our helicopters. It's for the SH-3 Alphas, which is an anti-submarine warfare helicopter. So I explained the differences for the rest of the flight. So it was a good flight.
And I know we're going to hear about a couple missions in particular for which you were decorated, but you mentioned multiple deployments flying the Clementines first. Anything stand out about that time? Can you give us a sense of what kind of flights you were making, what the purpose of them was, what your duty over there was?
Our duty was we deployed from the carriers, and we were aboard non-aviation ships, either cruisers or destroyers that could hold a helicopter. Our purpose was to stand search and rescue for Vietnam War, where I was on alert 30 status. We had to be ready to launch within 30 minutes from three stations, from Northern Station, which was called Oswald, and Southern Station, which was called Red Crown, and we always had an aircraft on a carrier. That's our Yankee Station. So we always had a helicopter and a crew on those three boats, on those three geographic locations at all times.
So you just had to be ready to jump into action, because if there's a pilot down somewhere, he needs rescuing now. Time really matters.
Yes.
How often did that happen?
Oh, not very often. Our squadron was formed in 1967, and from 67 to maybe 70, it was quite active. Then from 70 to 72, there was no very little action. Then it started up again in 1972. That's when I kind of got over there.
There's a mission at the end of July in 1972 for which you were awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. What can you tell me about that mission?
Well, that was my third flight in the HH-3 helicopter. And the first flight I got a rescue. My very first flight in the H-3 helicopter, I go over with Bill Young. We're brand new H-3 pilots. My very first mission, I get a rescue. An F-4 had, Air Force F-4 had gotten hit over land. He made it out to the water. That was our primary area of responsibility, was from the water outwards to sea. We saw the guys eject, and we saw them punching out. We had to wait for them to land in the water, and we picked one up, and we had another big mother out there. The other big mother picked up the other pilot, and so that was pretty good. Then a week later, I flew, it was 3rd of July, yes, at DFC. I was the aircraft commander on that flight. We launched. We were to make a call. I switched radios to ship. I told them there's a plane had gone down, and they were looking for a SAR asset. Could we be released?
And when you say SAR asset, that's a search and rescue target, basically, someone that you'll be able to rescue.
Yes. So I told them that we were available. So, okay, follow us. They came and they let us into Haiphong Harbor. We're in Haiphong Harbor. Well, we didn't know what to expect there. So they're shooting artillery guns at us, heavy artillery, 100-millimeter shells. A little danger of them really hitting us, except that they make big explosions in the water. So we came there. We saw the back end of an F-4 sticking out of the water. That's how shallow Haiphong Harbor is, sticking out of the water. So we knew we were close. Then we saw a guy splashing in the water. We went and picked him up right away. And our crewman, we normally do 10-10 drops. 10-10 drops. We come in real fast, pull nose up, rocket over. We're about 10 feet and 10 knots. Swimmer jumps out. And we take off and then come around and pick him up again. So we got the first guy without any problem. The second guy, he had to let off his smoke. We didn't need his smoke, except that he now became a target. They started bracketing with shells. We're afraid to put a crewman in the water now. Said, hey, hopefully you get in the sling. He got into the sling and we started moving off. Just as we moved off, a mortar hit his raft and it flew right up in the air.
So I just want to make sure people are following this. As part of your search and rescue operation, you have a guy on board your helicopter whose job is to go into the water to collect these guys and make sure they get in this sling and are lifted back to the helicopter, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And a search and rescue swimmer. Swimmer's job is to jump into the water as needed.
And so that worked with the first occupant of this downed plane. But there's another person still in the water who decides to put up a smoke signal, making sure that you guys see him. And you're saying you didn't really need that in situation. You knew where he was already, right?
That's correct, yes.
But when he did put that smoke up, that told the enemy where he was, and they started firing on where he was?
Yes, then they could see where he was. They see a smoke signal coming from the water. We were about 10 miles from shore. They couldn't see him.
But now they know where he is, so they're firing on that spot. So that fire, enemy artillery fire, puts him in jeopardy and the rest of you in jeopardy, right?
Yes. Now they can bracket in pretty close.
And had you ever been in anything like that before?
No, first time I've ever been fired at.
What did that feel like?
Well, it felt like I didn't want to do it again.
You know, when you're in those moments that no lecture or film or simulation can prepare you for, what goes through your mind? What was going through your mind at the controls of that helicopter?
Well, you're so busy flying the airplane, you really don't have time to think about anything else. You're just concentrating on doing your job, doing your mission. And our mission is to pick people up and get them aboard as quickly as we can.
Yeah, in fact, I've seen a couple times in references to your unit that your purpose was to prevent prisoners of war. You don't want these guys to end up in the Hanoi Hilton or anywhere else. So you're trying to make sure they not only get out of that alive, but they're not captured and they can return to duty. So I think we have an understanding of the situation and how treacherous it was for all of you. So what happened next?
They started firing us, so we had them on board. They started moving off, and then we just jigged out of there as fast as we could.
So you were able to get the second guy out of the water?
We got the second guy out of the water, yeah. We brought him up to the hoist, up to the door. We slowed down a little bit, and we kicked the rudder a little bit, and it was on our right side. We kind of slowed down, put a little bit of left rudder in, and that tilts the helicopter up a little bit, and he lets the hoist down, and he slides right into the cargo door.
But you did that while enemy fire is still incoming?
Well, yes, yeah, they followed us up for about 10 miles. They followed us up with artillery shells, but we could easily avoid the water spouts.
You say that, Harry, like that's no big deal, but this is your life and the rest of your crew and these two guys you just picked up.
Yes, that's true.
It sounds like you're flying for those 10 miles a bit of an obstacle course, because shells are hitting the water and you need to veer left or right to avoid that?
Yes, so you see explosions of the water going up in the air, we just avoid them.
But if you make a wrong turn or a wrong move, that could be it for all of you.
I guess that's right, yes. And in retrospect, that's exactly right. But in reality, we're just flying. We want to go off here, we want to go off there, we want to go off there. We just kind of avoided them.
Were you scared at all while that was going on?
I think so. But there's a big pucker factor, yeah.
And so that was July 30th, 1972, and they gave you a Distinguished Flying Cross.
Yes.
And when you get home, when you get back to the ship after a mission like that, is there like a decompression, a exhale, a relief? Or are you saying, boy, when's this going to happen again?
I said, it's okay with me if I never have to see enemy fire again.
But that's not how it worked out.
No. It's not what the Lord had in store for us at all.
Not by a long shot. He would encounter plenty more enemy fire, especially on August 6th, 1972. We'll hear about the mission that earned Harry the Navy Cross when we come back. Check out photos and a special video with Harry at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.